we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
And no Maria this morning. She's feeling under the weather. So.
Yes, that weather being a tropical sun. But yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. I thought I heard surf in the background when she called. Those international calls, they sound so local now.
Yeah, that's amazing, the clarity. All right.
Lots going on this week.
Lots going on.
I thought it was going to be a dead news week, but no.
All right, starting with local and machinists.
Yeah, the vote for the machinists for the Boeing hostage-taking, I mean terrorism, I mean new contract, I mean, you know, whatever you want to call it, is in. And a yes vote took the day with 51% of a vote that was actually much lower in terms of turnout than the first vote. That's because the vote was held over the holidays, depressing the turnout, which was probably an intentional strategy on behalf of Boeing. And the vote essentially pitted national leaders of the IAM, the machinist union, against local leaders, the local leaders being adamant in rejecting the contract and the national leaders, pushing heavily to accept it. Unlike media coverage, this was not a contract extension. It's basically a brand new contract that, basically does the same thing for the union that it did for the state, which is, you know, take hostages and then the threat of jobs for the 777X, demanded in this case pretty much the crushing of the union. And the media coverage of it, particularly in the notoriously anti-union Seattle Times, is pretty appalling. This quote from the Times this morning, quote, "The region's economy is assured of high employment at Boeing for a decade to come and likely more." Now, that was not an editorial. That was in the news section, explaining the likely result of the contract. The only problem with that, of course, is that the contract itself very explicitly states that Boeing has the right to terminate it at any time, which they haven't done since, their current contract, which they threw out the window in order to try and impose this one. So no, it doesn't really guarantee anything of anything from the Boeing standpoint, except that they can they now have a floor that they can then turn to other states or other locations if they want to try and urge them to beat. So you know, Boeing has said that the 777 will be manufactured in Everett, and we'll see how long that lasts, because the management at Boeing has been really making it clear for some time that their goal is to keep labor costs as low as possible, even at the expense of quality or customer satisfaction or anything like that. That is why all of their subcontracting is done overseas right now. The extent to which they do manufacture locally is pretty much tied to the U.S. government requirements for their military contracts that the final assembly take place in the United States. And so that final assembly will take place in Everett, but a lot of the subcontracting for it will not. And if they can find a cheaper labor force in a non-union state than as like in South Carolina or any number of other states, they will still try and go for that. That's what they tried to do this time. They got an enormous corporate welfare package from the state legislature in a special session in 4 days last November, and they will continue to try and beat that. And when they do, you can expect politicians and local media to fall over themselves again about what a great deal it is. The interesting thing about the media coverage, both on TV and the Times this morning, you had plenty of photos of machinists and their allies, like literally openly weeping on the floor of the machinist hall when the vote total was announced. And nobody ever really explained that. Nobody ever really explained why people locally were so upset that this passed. But I guess that's because it's such great news.
All right. Moving on. Mayor Murray, the new mayor.
Well, mayor-elect. He doesn't get sworn in until Monday.
Okay.
But he certainly is about to become mayor, and announced yesterday that his first act as new mayor will be issuing an executive order to raise city employees' minimum wages to $15 an hour. This basically being a good faith gesture as a result of a lot of pressure from Councilmember-elect Shama Somont and the SIU and various other labor forces to try and raise the minimum wage immediately to $15 an hour, whereas Murray has promised a, you know, named a commission to study it, and there are a lot of fears that, well, while studying it is going to be somewhere along the line of the proposals by both Murray and McGinn during the campaign season that were not immediate implementation. And so we'll stagger it in sometime over the next 2 or 3 years. Whereas, you know, people are trying to pay their rents immediately and it doesn't help immediately. So Murray's trying to get out ahead of the issue, and that is all well and good and excellent for him to do. It only affects about 600 people in the, out of the 10,000 or so that work for the city of Seattle. About 600 make less than the $15 an hour minimum wage, mostly things like park attendants and various other service employees. This again puts the ball pretty much squarely back in the in city council's lap once the swearing-in ceremony is held on Monday. Sawant announced this week something I had talked about last week, the launching of an outside grassroots organization called 15now.org that will push for an immediate $15 an hour minimum wage. There are at least three different proposals at the city council level for a $15 an hour minimum wage. So this is an issue that's going to be in front of us for 2014, and hopefully by the end of the year we will have that actually enacted for more than just city employees. We'll have it citywide. That'll be very exciting to see. But between Sawant and her supporters, Murray at City Hall, SEIU, which wrote the CTAC ordinance that passed in November and is a major player behind efforts to get an initiative on the ballot for this year, this is going to be something we're going to hear a lot about in coming months, and I think it'll happen.
Didn't the Port of Seattle just challenge the $15 rate at the CTAC?
Yes, they did. And there was also a court ruling that in the Port of Seattle's behalf, the actual workers at the airport, which were the driving force behind the initiative in SeaTac, are not covered by the SeaTac ordinance because the Port of Seattle is a separate taxing authority, and therefore they're not subject to the city of SeaTac's laws, which probably will be appealed, I would think.
Moving on, initiative, getting enough signatures.
Yeah, speaking of initiatives, we had at the state level an initiative to close the gun show loophole called I-594. Almost certainly will be on the ballot this coming November. That initiative would require criminal back checks for gun purchasers at gun shows and online checks. The backers of that initiative submitted about 95,000 signatures on Thursday after the first of the year to the Secretary of State at deadline, on top of the $250,000 signatures they'd already submitted last fall. The measure only requires a little under 250,000 valid voter signatures to earn a place on the ballot, so that almost certainly will put them over the top. Already likely qualified, they had submitted another 5,000 this past week, but they had submitted more than enough this fall. Also, is I-591, which is sponsored by gun rights groups. And by the way, when did guns starting have rights? Is that like, guns are people too, my friend. Anyway, would prohibit government agencies from requiring background checks of any kind unless there's a uniform national standard, which, funny how conservatives are all for local and states' rights, except when it's stuff that they don't want. So that is almost certainly going to be on the ballot as well in November. So we're going to have dueling initiatives likely on the ballot now this coming November around guns. One of them that would require background checks in a way that the federal government was too scared and cowardly to do, and our state legislature as well. And the other that would basically prohibit any kind of background checks, even though that's something that, according to polls, over 90% of people in the United States and over 90% of people in Washington State support. So we'll see how that plays out in November.
All right. And Friday News Dump, they finally revealed what is currently blocking Bertha.
Yeah, it's a steel pipe. After all the exotic speculation about what it might be, and this again goes down to It's kind of a cute news story, except it is a cute news story that has buried within it a number of other delays that were and cost overruns that were associated with the problem. This pipe, in particular, apparently was something that when it was installed as part of, I believe it was utility work or something like that, over a decade ago, just didn't make it into the planning documents around what they would find when they dug. And so once again, as has beset this project really over the last year, there have been a number of delays. There have been a number of construction accidents and problems with utility lines and whatnot. I mean, they had the preparatory work for the tunnel boring machine shut down for a while last summer at one end because of issues like that. And it gets back to the issue that soon-to-be former Mayor McGinn raised years ago about cost overruns and who would be responsible, and it looks like we're going to find out.
All right. On to national and unemployment insurance.
Yeah, Congress gets back into session on Monday, which I know will be sad news for just about any sentient being. The first order of business on the books of the Senate will be extension of the unemployment insurance, which ran out on January 1st and which was not extended in the budget deal that Senator Patty Murray and House of Representatives Paul Ryan cut in December. That meant that 1.3 million long-term unemployed folk had their benefits run out the first of the month. The problem with this and the problem with the Democrats making it a priority in the Senate is that there is no evidence whatsoever that the House of Representatives will even consider extension, even though since the beginning of the Great Recession in 2008, it's been extended something like 21 times. And the reason for this is very simple. It involves spending, and it involves spending for poor people. And that is something that apparently Republicans don't believe in. This begs a larger question is, you know, since when did it become acceptable in this country for 1/3 million people to be out of work for longer than 6 months? And that's people who were on payroll before. It's not including self-employed people, contractors. It's not including people who've been out of the workforce and are trying to come back in, or people who've been out so long that they've stopped looking for work or tried to go back to school or do something else. There is a huge and growing permanent underclass in this country of people who are underemployed or who are flat out unemployed, nothing's being done about it. We had a jobs initiative that was proposed by Obama in 2010 that went absolutely nowhere, for the same reason now that unemployment insurance extension is also going nowhere, which is we have a political party in this country that doesn't believe in doing things. Session of Congress that just ended for the year 2013 was passed the fewest number of bills in congressional history by a factor of, I believe, about six. So it's not good times if you're relying on the legislative branch of government to, I don't know, solve anything.
All right. And the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah. On the other hand, from way back in the days of 2010, when stuff could occasionally be passed, the Affordable Care Act reached a milestone on Wednesday with the turning of the new year, which is when insurance coverage went into effect for the millions of people who've been signing up on exchanges and for the expansion of Medicaid in states that allowed it. Those folks are covered as of January 1st. So as flawed as the ACA is, the fact that you have to actively sign up for it, as opposed to having, say, a single payer system that everybody is automatically enrolled for and not have to deal with all this stuff, that you're not at the whim of having to live in a state controlled by the Republican Party, which is, you know, refusing to spend, money on implementing this system in terms of the expansion of Medicaid, for example. And trying to do everything possible to stop it. You know, the Republicans did everything up to and including shutting down the government to try and prevent millions of people from getting insurance on January 1st, and they failed, and that is a piece of good news. Hopefully, as people get used to the ACA, get used to having healthcare coverage. They'll see the flaws in it as not a reason that that the ACA is a failure, but the reason it needs to be strengthened and the reason why we need universal coverage, true universal coverage, and not one that relies on for-profit insurance companies as a profit-sucking middle person that will still lead us to a healthcare system with too many expenses and too few good results.
All right. Moving on, I know we were all hoping that Joe Lieberman would land on his feet.
Well, one end or the other. I don't know that feet was the particular end I was hoping he'd land on. But yes, the former senator from Connecticut, who champion of the people and so forth, now that he's retired from the Senate, has a new job. It was announced over the holidays. And, you know, given his propensity for promoting war and advancing the cause of the state of Israel, where he is also a citizen, and some other things he is notorious of, but also his long history in the Senate of carrying water for the insurance industry, since a lot of that's based out of Connecticut. It was a real question whether he'd wind up as an arms dealer or a predatory capitalist, and the verdict is now in, and predatory capitalist wins. Announced over the holidays that former Senator Lieberman will now be a partner at something called Victory Park Equity, which is setting itself up as an alternative to Bain Capital as a vulture capitalist that will come in, buy what they call small but are actually mid-sized companies, lay off their employees, strip it of its assets, destroy it, and then sell it off again for parts, basically. So, this is what happens to people after after decades and decades in Congress. They retire to a nice, cushy job, continuing to make lives miserable for millions of people. It's a holiday story to warm the cockles of one's heart.
And that revolving door continues to revolve.
Yes. Did you say revolting or revolving?
Either apply, but I said revolving.
Okay.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Benghazi.
Yeah, a lot of international news this week. Just because there are holidays doesn't mean the rest of the world stopped. An excellent New York Times report last Sunday, based on their own investigations and interviews with Libyans in Benghazi, as well as some declassified documents, that Susan Rice was actually telling the truth with that notorious Sunday morning chat show interview that basically derailed her career, that what happened in Benghazi, according to the Libyans who were there, and all available evidence, that the attack on the U.S. consulate there was done by local militias, not affiliates of al-Qaeda. It was primarily motivated by an American-produced evangelical hate video and similar protests around that video in Egypt. And it was spontaneous rather than being long-planned. And, you know, the money quote from the article, which is a rather long piece, months of investigation by the New York Times centered on an extensive interviews with Libyans in Benghazi who had direct knowledge of the attack there and its context turned up no evidence that al-Qaeda or other international terrorist groups had any role. The attack was led instead by fighters who had benefited directly from NATO's extensive air power and logistics support during the uprising against Colonel Gaddafi. Contrary to claims by some members of Congress, those would be Republicans trying to shore up Mitt Romney's presidential campaign all during 2012. Contrary to claims by some members of Congress, it was fueled in large part by anger at an American-made video denigrating Islam, which, of course, was made by, you know, conservative American Christians. You know, for something that happened over 2 years ago at this point and is still being used by the right as a flagging horse, and they don't want to let it die because they're trying to tie it to Hillary Clinton, in case who was Secretary of State at the time, in case she decides to run for president in 2016. But, you know, we've always known that this is a nothing burger of a scandal, that there is no there. But the fact that almost all of the claims of the right about what motivated the attacks and, you know, advanced intelligence that the U.S. should have had, yada, 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 and who was behind it and so forth. All of that turns out to be an utter fiction. And yet, this story, you know, should have been headline news. Instead, the New York Times, which apparently spent considerable resources trying to investigate this thing, buried their investigative story between Christmas and New Year's when not that many people were paying attention, when Congress is not in session, when, in fact, most of the political press in this country is not paying that much attention. And, you know, we have a right wing in this country also that is going to say, oh, well, it's the New York Times, it's the liberal media, of course they're making this stuff up. It's not going to have any impact. Just because it's true doesn't mean it's going to have any impact, and we're going to keep hearing about this stuff. And we're going to be hearing about the lies a lot more than we hear about the truth. So just something to keep in mind, that these claims have been investigated and they have been thoroughly discredited.
All right, moving on. Situation in Iraq.
Yeah. The gift that keeps on giving, now that it's been over a decade since the original U.S. Invasion and occupation of Iraq. And the war there, as we see, continuing to not be a success, and is now somewhat seemingly starting to merge with the sectarian conflict and the civil war in Syria. We've talked quite a bit in 2013 about the splintering of the opposition groups in Syria and how you have, in particular, a schism between Islamist groups there and various other armed factors that are being backed by the Gulf states and being backed by Saudi Arabia and being backed by the United States, and being armed by the United States as well as those other countries. And now we have the Islamist groups basically trying to take on the government of Iraq and trying to make that into one conflict. And for anybody who's familiar with the geography of the region, the national borders in that part of the world were basically set by the British Empire about a century ago and don't have a whole lot to do with sort of the traditional nations as they're constituted, or traditional peoples there. And the border between Iraq and Syria in that part of the world is basically in a desert and doesn't really have any natural boundaries there. It just goes, you know, people go back and forth quite freely historically between the two areas. So now we have a group calling itself the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which, according to U.S. media anyway, is affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Of course, you know, given what U.S. media characterizations in Benghazi, take that with a grain of salt. But they are radical Islamists. That much is very clear. They are treating the conflicts in Iraq and Syria as one. And Anbar province, which is primarily Sunni, which saw some of the most serious fighting with American forces when they were there all through the last decade, and which in particular was site of the notorious Battle of Fallujah in 2004, where the U.S. basically laid waste to a major Iraqi city, including well-documented use of phosphorus weapons and various other chemical weapons that are very much war crimes. Well, Fallujah this past week seen once again of heavy fighting, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria claiming that it now controls Fallujah and issuing forth the claim that it is now an independent state that is not part of either Iraq or Syria. Those claims, of course, being immediately disputed by the central government of Iraq in Baghdad, and fighting continues there. But the ISIS, which is the acronym for Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, at least in English it is, now in controlling a fair amount of territory in Al-Anbar province, which, as I said, is mostly desert. So, you know, a lot of that area, controlling it means controlling a lot of sand, but a lot of the villages and whatnot in that area too. Ramadi, which is the capital of the province and the other major city in that province, also the scene of very heavy fighting this week. And, you know, none of this, all of this set in motion originally by the invasion in 2003, and also very, very good evidence, as we continue to see also a deepening schism between the Islamist groups and other armed groups, let alone the nonviolent, protesters that originally kicked off the challenges to the Syrian government, evidence once again of the complexity of the region and being thankful that the Obama administration was not bullied, or did not bully itself into more direct U.S. involvement last summer.
All right, Egypt.
Yeah, speaking of messy politics in the Middle East, on January 13th coming up next weekend, the end of next weekend, there'll be a constitutional vote in Egypt for a new constitution that's being proposed by the military government there after their coup last year. And trying to set up for a return to democracy, but of course this time a democracy where only the people we like get to run for office. 13 people died yesterday as the military has been cracking down in advance of that vote, arresting Muslim Brotherhood protesters, and reportedly rounding up a lot of the leaders and jailing there, arresting hundreds of them. And that is going to continue to be a mess there leading up to those elections in 10 days. And once again, that military being able to do what it's doing and the notorious human rights violations that have been happening over the last number of months, primarily because they're a major benefactor, that being the United States military.
All right. And Afghanistan.
Yeah. A CNN survey out this week, and the least popular war ever that polling has ever been conducted on in the United States. Now, granted, the Spanish-American War was not subject to Gallup polls, as far as I'm aware, nor some of the others farther back in history. But only 17% of Americans support the U.S. continued military involvement in Afghanistan, which is remarkably low for an armed conflict, which the American public is usually not as supportive of as media and politicians would have you believe, but they're generally pretty supportive. But not in this case. But the fact that we have been there for well over a decade now, continue to not make very much progress at all, except in the glorious victory of propping up an incredibly corrupt local government. You know, most Americans don't want us there anymore. The Obama administration has claimed that it will be pulling out by the middle of this coming summer. That deadline having been pushed back for several years already after Obama's initial surge in 2009. And we'll see whether that happens and what the future of Afghanistan holds. But the American public certainly wanting no part of future U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, just as they wanted no part in future involvement in Iraq.
Events.
A number of them coming up now that we're back in the busy signal season. As mentioned earlier, the count swearing-in ceremonies for our new mayor and city council members and the city attorney will be happening at City Hall on Monday afternoon at 3:30. Because that is happening in the middle of the day and people can't hold it there, there will also be for new council member Shama Sawan an after-party that they're trying to organize when people can actually come. That will be happening. The details haven't been finalized yet, but my understanding is it will probably be around 6 o'clock at the SEIU headquarters, which would be 3720 Airport Way South, south of downtown. On Tuesday, January 7th at 7 o'clock, Reclaiming Prosperity, Innovation in the Northwest, and the Future of Labor with former SEIU National President Andy Stern. That'll be at Town Hall. $5 ticket will get you in to see Andy. 8th and Seneca for Town Hall events. Thursday, January 9th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Across the lunch hour, there will be a vigil for Fukushima Transparency and International Action that will be happening outside the Japanese consulate in downtown. That consulate is at 2 Union Square, so it'll be in the plaza outside Union Square at 6th of Union downtown this coming Thursday, noontime. And then also on Thursday, January 9th, 7 o'clock, What If Soldiers Refused to Fight? A presentation with Brian King, the author of So Long Vietnam, a new book about stories of GI resistance in that era. That'll be part of the new season of Common Good Cafe, kicking off once again post-holidays. That at 7 o'clock next Thursday at University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District in Seattle.
Talking with Jav Parrish with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.